Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the second half of my conversation with Diane K. Boyd, one of the first female biologists in the United States to study wild wolves in their natural habitat. She's also the author of A Woman Among Wolves, My Journey Through 40 Years of Wolf Recovery. This is her story of passion, her resilience, and her determination. If you haven't yet listened to the first half of our conversation, I encourage you to do so. Head to mtpr.org. Let's get back into it. This is my conversation with Diane K. Boyd, author of A Woman Among Wolves.
I've had many great opportunities because I volunteered a lot as a young person.
I don't know how else to ask this question, but what did it feel like to be a woman in those spaces, especially early on?
I get asked that question about being a woman in early days. And, you know, I kind of just didn't really think about it because there wasn't the Me Too movement. There wasn't all this stuff going on. And I was always a bit of a tomboy. And I just put my head down and pushed harder. If there was a little wall put up in front of me, I'd put on my climbing spikes and I would go up over it. And I just, it's just who I am. I'm a driven person. And so I really didn't think about it too much. In those early years. But it was pretty obvious. I mean, when I asked Dave Meech about when I was writing this book, I said, were there other women biologists doing what I was doing? And he said, nope, not at that time. There weren't women out there trapping and radio collaring and doing the field work. They were maybe assisting other people, but they, if there were any, they just, it wasn't done. Yeah. So I really didn't think about it a lot. I just did the job, and I'm not a whiner.
Well, I mean, I will point our listeners and you, Diane, to a certain point in the book wherein you're not amidst other biologists or managers, but you are in the midst of loggers in the area and trappers in the area, other men in the area.
Oh, yeah.
And you did find yourself in some situations that you felt uncomfortable in because of the fact that you are a woman outnumbered by men.
Definitely. And I didn't, not many people know these stories. And when I wrote the book, I thought I have to include a couple of these really kind of awful scenarios because they're part of shaped who I am. And I'm hoping that if there's young women out there reading this book, that they will be inspired. Or if there's men out there reading the book, they will realize some faux pas to not be repeated. So, oh yeah, I had my challenges. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was some of those things were really difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I thank you for including them. It kind of gave me as a reader and as a woman a more holistic view of your experience out in the backcountry.
And because I moved out of home when I was 18, I've been very independent all my life. I've learned to be self-sufficient, and calling somebody for help or was not part of who I was.
Yeah.
I problem solved every single day of my life. I come out from the Twin Cities. I moved to the middle of nowhere with no power and no water. It's like, what's this? Oh, it's a chainsaw. Well, I guess I'll learn how to cut firewood. I mean,
yeah.
That's just who I am. And facing these adversities, I just move forward.
Well, one of the ways in which, I don't want to say you compensated or overcompensated in those spaces, was just really proving your competency and proving your resilience in those spaces. But as one of your readers, one of the unexpected joys of this memoir, for me, I will say, was that you allow your readers into your humility. You learn a lot in the space of these pages. You make a lot of mistakes too. So talk about your relationship to, I guess what I'll call failure, but also regret in the backcountry when often the person who's passing judgment is actually you.
That is another good point. I learn by doing, and I Yeah, I made some pretty serious mistakes, but didn't cost anybody their lives or any animals their lives. But like catching three wolf pups and binding them and putting them in the front seat of my truck to call my boss back in Minnesota to ask him. I said, well, you told me not to collar them unless they weigh 30 pounds or more. And these three are right on the cusp. And I'm on this, standing at a payphone out at a gas station. And all of a sudden I see this group gathering around my truck. The wolves had freed all their bindings off. They got the ropes off. They got the tape off their muzzle. And they were running around the inside of my cab. It's like, that was a really important lesson because I had to go in that cab and secure them. And then there were bite marks all over my steering wheel on the inside of the cab. Lesson number one, you know, don't turn loose wild wolves that aren't sedated in your vehicle. So anyway, and, you know, nothing serious happened, but I learned from it. And I don't know, other specifics?
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, you're an active and action-oriented person. So yes. when a mistake happened, you learned from it. You yes. just kept going. So yeah, I guess my question was just your relationship to those ideas of failure and regret and how you moved forward.
So I'm a pretty sensitive person. I feel things deeply, but I often don't express them. So when something bad comes up, I'll do my best to push through, but I think about it a lot, and sometimes it haunts me. And I often, in various parts of the book, will feel insufficient or incompetent. And all you can do is learn from mistakes. I mean, mistakes for me have always been the best teacher, not competence, but incompetence, so that I don't repeat it.
Sure.
And those lessons really stick. You remember the negative really well. And every day there was challenges, and so I just dealt with it as best I can. And feeling it, yeah, I feel things pretty deeply.
Which is maybe proven by their place in this book. Someone else may have just left those moments out and maybe glorified some of the experiences that they had with wolves on these landscapes. But some of these stories, like, you didn't do that. You laid bare what actually happened. And like I said, you really showed your humility, which again was one of the many joys of digging into this memoir.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I mean, you got to remember, I was born and raised in Minnesota. Minnesota nice. Good Lutheran girl. I mean, you know?
Sure.
And I'm very honest. I wear my heart on my sleeve, except when it comes to dealing with certain aspects of my profession, like when somebody rails against wolves or against the research or against me personally or against my colleagues, I will sit and listen for a bit. And I take so much of it. And I'll wait till we get to the point where the person is done yelling or blathering. And then I'll begin addressing the issue. But I can hold that. I can hold that in check. But I'm still feeling it inside. Maybe my stomach's turning a bit. Mm. I mean, you've read some of the passages in the book where something's going on, but I'm very calculated and cold on the outside. And then later it comes back.
Sure.
When the adrenaline is gone.
Sure. I want to talk about the ways, like kind of just like on the ground, what you were doing with wolves at this time. Can we talk a little bit about how you were capturing wolves, what you were doing when you were collaring them and tracking them? Can we talk about, kind of about the mechanics of that?
Yeah. So I have to say we were in the olden days, it was pretty primitive. And then I worked up to my career to modern times now. And, you know, I retired 5 years ago. And now we were like catching with helicopters and putting on GPS collars and doing DNA. But those early days, there was, picture it, no GPS, no satellite, no telephone, no cell phone, no internet. There wasn't a resource you could look up Wikipedia to find an answer, you know.
Right.
So you, every day you're making decisions based on reacting or being proactive and then having to react to a situation. But our typical day would start in the wintertime. We would go out and take the receivers and listen for wolf signals. And once we located where the wolves were, we would go to where we'd heard them the day before, and we would go to the previous location and we would backtrack them. We never wanted to forward track them because we didn't want to affect their movements and behavior by us being on their tails.
Mm-hmm.
So we backtracked them. That was typical. We would cross the river, North Fork of the Flathead, in the winter with chest waders and skis and lunch and backpacks and whatever, and then hit the wolf tracks just using a compass. There's no GPS.
Mm-hmm.
there's no spot to face. You get hurt, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And then we would ski along on the wolf tracks, backtracking, and we would look at every single spot where they sniffed, stopped, urinated, pick up scats, where they made kills. You could see the habitat they used. You could see where they paused to stop to look around. You could see where the one heavier one would fall through the ice and then scramble to pull himself. The snow, I'm such a Viking. I so love tracking and seeing the record in the snow. You can't get that from radio collar locations. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty intimate view of what the wolves were doing.
Yeah.
And you could also count the number of wolves as the tracks got to a wide spot and separated. The summer field work really was taking the advantage of my knowledge from the winter trails to track them in the summer to be able to trap them. And I would know how they traveled. I would know the routes they used. And so I'd spend the summer months trapping them with modified foothold traps and putting radio collars on them and taking blood samples and weights and measurements and look at parasite and do disease profile in the blood sample and radio collar and just the standard battery of things that people do. Mm-hmm. That was really interesting because in the summertime, you couldn't track them and you couldn't go on their kills in the summer because there could be grizzly bears on them. So you couldn't look at the kills. Wintertime, we generally thought we were pretty safe when you're skiing on a wolf track and then ravens get up. But as you read some stories in the book, not true. Grizzly bears are out in the dead of winter too.
Yeah, it occurred to me while reading that being a wildlife biologist who specializes, in your case, in wolves, you're not actually just specializing in wolves. You're really specializing in the ecosystem in which they live because there are all these other creatures surrounding them and interacting with them and all of that. It was really fun to experience the different wildlife that you came across while doing this work.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Thank you. I learned so much about mountain lions and bears and coyotes, not just the creatures, but then the scavengers that would come in. And then not just the kills, but then I learned about how alive the river is and how she treats you in different seasons. And I learned about ice on the frozen lakes and what the sounds would mean when you're crossing. I mean, and then there's just every aspect, the changing colors. I'm very scent oriented, and the smell of fall versus the smell of spring and the budding, the orange juice on the budding cottonwood trees. I mean, just, it was, well, back then they didn't have the word, but just a holistic approach.
Yeah. You're listening to A Conversation with Diane K. Boyd. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. I want to go back to this idea of maybe coexistence, but, you know, we started our conversation talking about the discourse around wolves and people. We really were talking about people. You write that in addition to doing the field work that you did and collecting the data, the key to wolf recovery success specifically was working with people. Yeah. My dad used to work for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and he used to say that managing wildlife means managing people. So talk about how your relationships with people influenced the ways that you approached wolves.
That when I was younger and doing the field work, my whole life was just wolves and doing the research and getting information and working with my crew and getting the data out. And I was a bit of a misanthrope, and I was a bit crunchy around the edges. I've heard it more descriptively, you know, than that, but a bit crunchy and hard to work with at times because I was so focused. And as I got more mature in my career and my outlook and opened my blinders a bit to look around and really look, what's the bigger picture of wolf conservation going to be about? It's not going to be looking at 100 more kills. It's going to be, how can we work with these people who are having struggles with wolves in the landscape? How can we replace cultural misinformation with science? That's a really hard one.
Yeah.
Because people fight science, and I don't care how accessible you make it, there's still some biases about listening to data. And I have to be, when I'm making talks, I'm pretty careful in how much graphics I put in. Equations, I don't put in any equations. They can leave that for the academic circles. But try to reach people at a level, at whatever level they're at and whatever their perspective, like my book. I think a person could pick up A Woman Among Wolves, and if they loved wolves or hated wolves or didn't know anything about wolves, I still believe they could take away a lot of information that they'll think about from this book.
Absolutely.
So that was kind of my goal. I don't push a viewpoint on anybody, although I'm obviously very passionate about wolves.
Yeah. Well, this idea of misinformation, I feel like it has spiked in the last, you know, how many years, obviously, because of our, you know, country's political climate. Have you changed the way that you talk about wolves publicly in light of kind of this spike of quote unquote misinformation? Or is it just holding steady at what you were doing?
Not really, because science is science.
Yeah.
That's all. No, and when I talk controversial topics or audiences that are not real receptive, I still just rely on the science. And the chapter on Trout Creek and The Woman Among Wolves, that's really laid out. And we did our best with science, but it didn't matter. The culture was dead set against learning anything or exchanging anything that could be good communication.
And I would actually argue that, yes, it's science, but one thing that this memoir has that maybe a talk wouldn't or other books wouldn't is there's like such explicit storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like the way into speaking to someone who might not be receptive to the science. It's actually just the storytelling, talking about your relationships really on the ground with these wolves and specifically individual wolves.
When I started writing A Woman Among Wolves, I started out by telling stories, and I end up linking through an overarching storyline all the chapters, and I slowly start weaving science in from the very beginning, but it's low level. And the more the reader gets engaged with the characters and the storyline, the more science gets in. And then some of the later chapters, I still tell a story of like Chernobyl or fear in wolves through research, other people's research. It was fun for me to write those kind of chapters because I had to learn new things. I'm the researcher and I want to make sure the facts are correct.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a book, and then at the end, I just kind of tried to pull it all together.
Yeah, with the chapter on resilience.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I felt it was really important to tell stories. And, you know, the reasons I wrote this book was, number one, because the story's never been told. It's never been written. And there are scores or hundreds of books about Yellowstone wolves, right?
Mm-hmm.
This has never been told. Number two, many of the people who were in that crew are dead now. Bob Ream's gone. Mike Fairchild's gone. People have moved on to other professions. So I'm sort of the last one standing. And I've been there throughout. And I've seen wolf population go from Kishnina 1 to 3,000 in the West. It's
yeah.
Like, wow, it's almost like science fiction. I mean, it's so remarkable. It's such a success story.
Yeah.
And three, I wanted it to be approachable to any reader to make them think about wolves. Those were kind of my goals. And I guess four, to weave the science in through the storytelling so that people could learn while they're being entertained.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, now might be a great time to have you read a passage or two from your book. Are you feeling ready for that?
Okay. I was trapping wolves in the North Fork, and this is an example of how things can go awry, and you got to think on your feet or on your seat. So June 20th, 1995, it was a cold, rainy, miserable day as Wendy Arjo, my PhD colleague, her volunteer Caitlin, and I checked wolf traps up Teepee Lake Road. The three of us walked a mile behind a locked Forest Service gate with our capture equipment and found a drenched, skinny wolf jumping around in my trap. I'd walked up to the wolf with my jab stick, and as she tried to get away, I gave her a quick poke in the rump with a syringe to tranquilize her. She went down quickly, and we fitted her with a radio collar and began processing her in the cold downpour. However, her initial temperature was on the low side for an excited, agitated wolf. She was drenched, shivering, and a candidate for hypothermia. Within 5 minutes of being tranquilized, her rectal temperature had dropped another degree, so I told Wendy and Caitlin that we must immediately pack this 72-pound wolf out to the truck, start the engine, and run the heater full blast to help her warm up. Temperature, pulse, and respiration rates are critical in monitoring the status of a sedated animal. The trend, going up or down, was more telling than a single reading. Her temperature was declining rapidly. Caitlin picked up the tarp and capture equipment while Wendy and I did our best to carry out this six-foot-long, soggy sack of potatoes in as humane a manner as possible. We made frequent stops to rest and swap positions. By the time we got to the pickup, the wolf's temperature had dropped another degree, and now I was truly worried. The trend was not good. Chili Wolf 9588 had a beautiful black coat, and her eyes, instead of being golden yellow, the usual color for wolves, were a striking pale blue, so we named her Ice. The three of us had completely filled the front seat of the truck when we had driven out to check our traps earlier that morning. Now we needed to make room for Ice, and there was no back seat. I asked Caitlin to please wait outside the truck in the rain at my driver's side window so we could all see each other. My plan was to have Wendy and I sit on the front seat with the shivering wolf on our laps so she could absorb heat from our thighs, all while having the heater going full blast. Then when the wolf's temperature had come up closer to the normal of about 100 degrees Fahrenheit and was continuing to rise, I would give Caitlin the thumbs up. She would open the driver's door from the outside so we could let the wolf out. We loaded the drugged wolf onto the front seat. Wendy and I crawled underneath her soaked black body and turned the heater up to the maximum. We managed to finish our processing and get a radio collar on her in cramped quarters. The interior of the truck was pretty much a stinky steam bath. We'd stripped off our wet rain gear, and a dense fog was now covering the insides of the windows, but Ice's temperature kept dropping. "Let's take off our shirts and press our upper bodies across Ice to totally wrap her with her body heat," I said. So we sat there in our sports bras, hugging this unresponsive wolf sprawled across our laps. We didn't say a word so as not to wake the wolf. I sat in the driver's seat, monitoring her eyes and ears, while Wendy, in the passenger seat at Ice's rump end, took rectal temperatures every few minutes. Poor Caitlin stood dutifully outside in the rain, watching us steaming in the truck. Wendy indicated with hand signals that Ice's temperature had finally stopped falling. It was now 6 degrees below normal. We had been warming this wolf in our truck for more than 2 hours, and finally we had reversed the hypothermia. Wolf's temperature began to rise. She stopped shivering, and my worries began to ebb. Her temperature continued to climb, slowly and steadily. Meanwhile, Wendy and I were about to expire from the heat. I gently reached over the wolf's head on my lap and clicked on the dial on the fan. At the sound of the click, one of the wolf's ears quickly snapped forward toward the sound. Nothing else moved except the telltale ear. I then realized that Ice was awake and aware, even though appearing to be immobile, with her mouth inches from my face. I vigorously pointed with my head toward Ice for Wendy to see, and her eyes grew wide with comprehension. We silently prepared to release Ice, and I gave the thumbs up to Caitlin watching through my window. She pulled the handle and flung the door open. Ice exploded from my lap. I grabbed the scruff of her neck with both hands and directed her wildly biting mouth away from me as she lunged for the steering wheel. Wendy braced against her door and vigorously pushed the wolf's rump my way. I couldn't let go of the wolf's neck for fear of being bitten. Wendy pushed harder. I hung onto the wolf, and together Ice and I slid out of the truck and plopped onto the muddy gravel road. Ice jumped up, and I let her go, and we all watched her wander off, albeit a little drunkenly, into the forest. Caitlin climbed into the truck, which stank of wet dog and sweaty women. Wendy and I in our sports bras covered with black hair looked like we'd slept with a gorilla. We watched Ice as she disappeared. She was looking good, and I hope she fared well after her ordeal. When we lost sight of her, Wendy and I got all our rain gear back on, and the three of us then giddily headed out to check the rest of the traps. A month later, I looked out my cabin window and saw a skinny black wolf in my driveway wearing a radio collar. I quickly grabbed the receiver and antenna from inside the cabin, and I confirmed that it was Ice's signal. Then she looked up at my window briefly. I saw those ice blue eyes, and I smiled.
Ice is not the only wolf who tracks you back to your homestead cabin in Moose City. Another female wolf, this one a really striking white wolf named Phyllis, also ended up near your cabin. And the implication as your reader in both of these stories, I felt, you know, whether other readers believe it or not, is that these wolves were acknowledging you or thanking you or, you know, kind of coming back and approaching you in that way. I'm not going to ask you if that's a fair reading. You nodded, however. So I'm curious, especially since we've talked about discourse and you just told me, you know, the reasons behind writing this memoir. I'm curious about what kinds of narrative decisions you made when you were writing this memoir, especially with Ice, Phyllis, Sage, these wolves who you were, you know, in contact with in really intimate ways. I'm curious about how you went about narrativizing these encounters. And again, with Ice and Phyllis, you end with them coming back to you and sort of acknowledging you. Will you talk about that?
Over the years I was there, there were special wolves that I knew had more experience with than others. I will never say that I knew because one can never know a wild wolf. But Phyllis was a wolf that I wrote a whole chapter about. And she had a really long history with us in research terms. And she was the one wolf that I could never catch. She had originally been caught in a grizzly bear snare by Bruce McClellan, the grizzly bear researcher. And despite my best efforts, and I'm a pretty darn good wolf trapper, I take pride in that, I could never catch her. And I go on and tell stories about the things she did to dig up my traps and mock me. And I so respected her for that. And she had, at one point, I tried to visualize the scene of her showing, maybe showing the other wolves what a trap was and all that. So I took a little liberty with that, just knowing canine behavior. But the rest of the story is all factual. And the chat, you know, she had a long life and it has kind of a sad demise. But there is no good ending for an old wolf. Mm-hmm. In the wild, there just isn't. But the chapter ends with her, the last time I saw her alive. She was still in the North Fork and she walked almost a mile, the entire length of our Moose City Meadow that was a runway that we landed our ski plane on. She walked that whole way in a straight line and came within spitting distance almost of my cabin, about 25 yards, and just looked at my cabin. And it's like, why would she do that? I think she was just trying to show me that she was still out there and still smarter than I am. I don't have an explanation for things like that. There's something deeper within the wolf's being that goes on that I hope we never understand.
Dan, thank you for joining me today. I so appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lauren. It's been a fun ride, and I'm really glad that you've taken an interest in it, and hopefully some of your readers will too.
That was Diane K. Boyd, author of A Woman Among Wolves, out now from Greystone Books. Diane holds a PhD in wildlife biology from the University of Montana. She divides her time between her home in Kalispell, Montana, and her beloved cabin on the North Fork. She is the author of numerous scientific papers on wolves. You've been listening to The Right Question. To listen to this conversation again, or to listen to the first half of my conversation with Diane, head to mtpr.org. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.